Good morning. May it please the court, Oliver Davis here for Mr. Garcia. May I reserve 2 minutes? This is Mr. Garcia's appeal from a conviction for allegedly being one of the perpetrators of a armed robbery of fellow drug acquaintances in a motel room in Snohomish County. I'd like to focus my argument this morning on the Confrontation Clause issue, specifically the trial court's erroneous admission of the recorded statements of Mr. Losey, one of the claimed victims, which he made when he was summoned to the telephone and questioned by the 911 operator who was originally speaking with the motel office clerk. The court has before it the tape recording of the telephone statement, and I think the court will find that useful for purposes of this issue. Certainly, the standard of review of the constitutional issue, the Confrontation Clause issue, is de novo. And in addition, the test for whether the state has met its burden to prove that this was a non-testimonial call for help is an objective test based on what a reasonable listener, and this court certainly is a reasonable listener, would conclude was the primary purpose of the caller. In this case, objectively speaking, one can conclude, I believe, only that the primary purpose of Mr. Losey, indeed his sole purpose, was not to call for help, but was to report a past completed event, and indeed to provide clever details which he believed would be useful for identifying and proving that the named individual was a person responsible for this crime. Now, certainly this is a report of completed past events. The time span since the alleged robbery is relatively short quantitatively. It's apparently as little as 5 minutes. But for purposes of whether this was a call for help, the time span is qualitatively significant because, according to Mr. Losey, he waited in the bathroom with his girlfriend until he was sure that the perpetrator had departed. Believing the situation to be safe, he then left the motel room and went to the clerk's office to report the crime. Certainly, this is not a call for help. This is not a situation where Mr. Losey was facing some sort of physical threat. This was not an ongoing beating. The perpetrators had departed. Mr. Losey certainly is not calling for assistance. He repeatedly states that he was not injured. He never asks for assistance. He never asks for help. The only time that assistance is mentioned in this telephone call is when the operator says, "Well, I'm going to send assistance." Now, certainly under Confrontation Clause doctrine, the questions that are asked by the operator are relevant to the analysis of what the primary purpose of the conversation was. To the extent only, however, that those questions characterize the answers that are given. The respondent is relying to a great extent on the fact that the operator seemed to be trying to obtain details that she could then provide to police officers who might look for this perpetrator. But those aren't the answers that Mr. Losey, and that isn't the information that Mr. Losey is interested in giving. This statement by him begins, of course, with the motel clerk saying, "We've got somebody here who say they were robbed."
On his subjective purpose. Why?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You focus a lot on his subjective purpose.
I have no intent to focus on his subjective purpose. I believe that if you look at the questions in the...
You said that that wasn't what Mr. Losey wanted to do or intended to do or something to that effect.
And my argument is that an objective listener, listening to the questions posed and the answers given, would conclude that the purpose of the caller...
That's not the test. The test is the purpose that reasonable participants would have had.
Well, participants plural, I believe, Your Honor, only refers to the fact that you do look to the questions that are asked. But if one focuses too much on only the questions that are asked...
The relevant inquiry is not the subjective or actual purpose of the individuals involved in a particular encounter. but rather the purpose that reasonable participants would have had.
Which is a determination that is objectively made based on the circumstances of the conversation. I certainly agree that I am no way trying to divine Mr. Losey's individual subjective
purpose. That's the difference between an excited utterance analysis and a confrontation clause.
I think that is the difference between the two doctrines, and I am not in any way suggesting that the court should do anything but determine the primary purpose of the interrogation and the questioning, however, based on what was said, objectively, but based on what was said. And in this case, if one looks at the transcript of this telephone conversation, it begins with confirming that nobody is injured, that there's no need for medical assistance, no need for help. And when the operator attempts to get information, and the state focuses on the operator's attempt to get information that might help the operator provide information to police, Mr. Losey's response is to be relatively reluctant and, frankly, quite unhelpful in providing that information, and instead providing these clever details that he believes will allow the person to be identified for purposes of apprehension, ultimately, and certainly not for purposes of apprehension to prevent danger to himself or others, but to prove that this is the person who did this. I know who he is. I don't know his last name, but he just got out of prison. The operator tries again to get information that might help officers, and Mr. Losey's response is, well, they took my phone, they took my keys, my car is locked. That's his response to which way did they go. So the operator's purpose is, admittedly, to resolve something, but those questions are only pertinent insofar as they characterize the nature of the answers, and he doesn't answer with information to resolve an ongoing danger. He repeatedly talks about how he's not injured, doesn't know how he's going to get his car open. Operator tries again. Did anybody see which way he might have gone? Well, he's got a room here two times. He's registered at this hotel, so you can definitely get him. In other words, you can prove this is the name of the individual. And then the call, the conversation ends with him saying, and I think this is a realization that his entire call, or a confirmation that his entire call is a naming of this individual, which is a testimonial statement, because he says, I'm afraid he's going to shoot me now. I'm snitching. Now, this court and the Supreme Court has said that the core class of testimonial statements always includes statements made under circumstances that would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that his statements would be available for use at a later trial. And when somebody is confirming that they're in a situation where there is no call for help and no emergency, when he confirms that he understands that he is inculpating this person that he is naming, he manifestly understands that he's bearing witness. And that statement is a core testimonial statement. Thank you.
Almost.
Your Honor, good morning. Andrew Alsdorf, on behalf of Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office, representing the respondent, State of Washington, in this matter. I'll go ahead and follow counsel's lead and begin by addressing the Confrontation Clause issue. Be happy to address other parts of this case as your honors may inquire.
Let's just start out at the beginning. Do you agree that the difference between the excited utterance analysis and the Confrontation Clause analysis, whether with regard to whether something's testimonial, is that one is focuses on the subjective intent of the declarant and the latter does not?
I certainly agree that the excited utterance analysis does involve a subjective component that is not clearly present in the Confrontation Clause analysis.
That's why they're not the same thing.
Right. But why, where I think the Confrontation Clause analysis gets a little bit confusing is when we come to the question of, well, when these statements are being made for what primary purpose, whose primary purpose? And while I wish that perhaps in Ohio versus Clark, the U.S. Supreme Court's most recent opinion on this matter, Justice Alito maybe could have been a little more clear about exactly whose purpose we're talking about, but I think ultimately the test that he announced answers clearly that it's both. It's the objective purpose of the caller, but also the objective purpose of the person asking the questions and all relevant circumstances that determine what is the primary purpose behind this interaction.
Well, wasn't that the core of his analysis in Crawford? It had to do with the questions that were being asked and the context and the answers that were given.
Right. But then as the case law has evolved, we then see that with, for example, a domestic violence situation such as in Davis, you have to consider the immediate purpose of someone who has faced a dangerous situation. And I think the Michigan versus Bryant court most directly addressed this point when they say it is possible, objectively speaking.
Well, that's an ongoing emergency.
And I would assert that this, too, was an ongoing emergency. And the point is that a person, in this case Brett Losey, the victim who talked to 911, can absolutely want the protection and aid of law enforcement in avoiding getting shot by someone who he just stared down the barrel of a gun in the course of an armed robbery, and yet not want to bear witness and have his recorded call used in a prosecutorial.
Well, what's the answer if somebody wants to be made safe, and then, to a lesser degree, they want the person to be prosecuted too? What's the answer?
Well, I believe when you started this discussion, you wanted to focus on the fact that this is an objective standard. So we can't really dive too deeply into the shadings or the degree to which Brett Losey wanted JT Garcia to ultimately be convicted of what he had done. We have to simply look objectively at what does it appear, objectively speaking, he was trying to accomplish. And what he was trying to accomplish was staying safe, making sure he didn't get shot, and making sure that the police could find him and get him so that he could stay safe. When the counsel has focused on the phrase that Brett Losey utters in the 911 call, he's gotten a room here twice so you can get him, that is clearly an indication that you can find out this person's identification, this person's first and last name, by looking in the hotel registry and in that way apprehend him. But when we're talking about objective facts and totality of the circumstances to objectively discern what Brett Losey's prosecutorial motive was, I believe the court is also entitled to look at how he interacted with the prosecution following this 911 call. And
why would that have anything to do with it?
Well, because as the facts bore out, he was entirely unhelpful with the prosecution. In fact, resisted efforts along the way to testify at all, and that's detailed.
So what?
Well, it shows that
we're talking about reasonable participants at the time of the engaged in that conversation.
Right.
So now we're gonna go into collateral matters. Did somebody change their mind? Why did they change their mind? Why does that matter? Isn't the purpose of making this an objective test based on the facts as they happened and imposing a reasonable participant standard to account for people who are unreasonable in their behavior and discount them but not alter the law?
Well, that may be a way of saying
that means it's all focused on what happened then, right?
I think you can still consider it. I'm hearing you say that it's perhaps less persuasive of a factor because it happened very much removed in time from the actual emergency.
Less persuasive a factor is probably better than so what. I'll give you that, yeah. If he had asked for the police to come down so he could talk to them, what would your argument be?
As in, does it matter that he wasn't the one who initially pressed 911?
No, as in, there's no indication here that he was looking for the police to respond to him personally. That's what counsel argues. Seems that the opposite of that is him asking them to come down so he can have a conversation with them or do something with them.
Well, he hasn't asked them to do anything other than apprehend JT. We don't know the exact circumstances of when they went to the hotel lobby. Was it his girlfriend or was it the hotel clerk who suggested calling 911? We don't know that. What we do know is that when he's placed on the phone, all he does is starts answering the dispatch operator's questions, which were clearly designed to provide officers with the relevant information they would need to set up a containment zone in a case where they don't know if the robbers have fled on foot or in a car. So that's a critical factor for the safety of the officers and the public at large. And all he expresses as to his desire in the purpose of the call is to say, I'm afraid he's going to shoot me now. He says, I'm afraid, and you can get him. And I think the reasonable interpretation of the combination of those two expressions is that he wanted them to get him because he wanted to stay safe. This is a man who was so distracted by staring down the barrel of a gun that he couldn't even answer basic questions like what color was the shirt that this man was wearing. He couldn't concentrate on that because he kept saying, I don't know, I had a gun pointed to my head. These are the kind of details that, honestly, objectively speaking, absolutely establish an ongoing emergency for law enforcement. And for the appellant to characterize this as a routine robbery, as if, it's a Motel 6 and there was drug socializing going on, so what do you expect, and it's not so much of an emergency after all. That's not supported by the record. The deputy who responded indicated that this was a large law enforcement response precisely because of the lack of information that they had about armed suspects who had fled the scene of an armed robbery. And so it's the immediate response to that situation.
Is whether something's the primary purpose or a secondary purpose a factual or a legal question?
I would call that a factual determination.
Can it be a factual determination if it's an objective standard?
I would say yes.
How does that work?
Well, an objective consideration is based on facts before the court. The facts in this case were essentially the transcript of the 911 call is the relevant facts here. And you can pick and choose from among those facts to determine what is a reasonable person's response or purpose in this situation. I do think that's a factual determination.
So we ask juries in tort cases to determine reasonable behavior as a matter of fact. This would be the same.
Yes, I would agree with that. Thank you.
I do think it's an objective test. I think we've sort of came to that conclusion in our...
Does that make it a factual question?
Makes it a legal question? Makes it a legal question.
What's a primary objective and what's a secondary objective?
What's the primary purpose? And here, I do not concede that there is a secondary objective. The respondent is using a subjective analysis when they characterize Mr. Losey's remarks as showing that he wants to stay safe. There's no indication of that, and that's why I provided the recording, and I thank the respondent for providing the transcript. There's no indication that he's giving the operator this information in order to set up a containment zone. He's giving clever details because he thinks he can prove who did this. They've registered at this hotel before. There's no indication that when he says there was a gun to his head, that that's the reason that he therefore was being uncooperative in providing identifying clothing details because he couldn't concentrate because he was scared. That's
a
subjective
analysis.
He was
looking into the barrel of a gun, correct?
He did say that. And when he said...
The court also listened to the tone of his voice and thought that it was rather agitated.
Well, that was the court's analysis of agitation in the excited utterance analysis. And I do believe that the court sort of mixed the two determinations, but the respondent is saying that when he says I'm afraid because I'm snitching, well, that shows that it's an ongoing emergency because therefore he must want the person to be caught so they can't retaliate against
him. His peril is increasing.
Pardon?
His peril is increasing.
Well, his peril may be increasing at some hypothetical future date, but that statement is significant because he understands that he is providing inculpating details and bearing witness against this person. And according to the Supreme Court...
Well, he understands that he's asking for him to be apprehended.
Well, I wouldn't even say that he was asking. Objectively speaking, he was not asking for apprehension. He never asks for anything except to give details. It was a formal question.
Okay.
He'd ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. Next up,